Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Dambisa Moyo grew up in Zambia, piled up degrees at American University in Washington, at Harvard, at Oxford. She worked at Goldman Sachs and the World Bank. And now this daughter of Zambia argues that the more than $1 trillion in aid that's gone to Africa has not helped the continent, but put it on life support, stifled entrepreneurship, fed corruption, made Africa's leaders beholden to the West. She says, stop the aid. Let the market take over. Development pros say that's dreaming. We'll hear the debate this hour on Point, debating aid to Africa. You can join the conversation. Could Bono be wrong? What about Dambisa Moyo? How do you see aid to Africa? Later in the hour, we'll hear from John MacArthur of the Millennium Promise, who argues Ms. Moyo is dead wrong. But first, joining us from London is Dambisa Moyo. She's former head of economic research and strategy for Sub-Saharan Africa at the investment bank Goldman Sachs. She's a former consultant to the World Bank. Her new book is Dead Aid. Dambisa Moyo, welcome. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom.
You've been out and talking a lot about this book and your thesis very recently in the United States and all over the place. What kind of response are you getting? We'll hear the thesis itself, but what's the reaction you're getting?
Actually, overwhelmingly positive. I think if I had to characterize the whole experience, it's been surprisingly, it's surprising in the sense that many people have been very positive about the thesis and the need to transform the continent and to really come up with a new, better solution. But also, I've been very pleasantly surprised by the quarters of support. So IMF and World Bank, I'm on my way now to see a number of ministers at their invitation at the Scandinavia, having spent time already in with a number of African governments, presidents included, who have invited me to discuss the thesis. So actually, I'm very, very happy. I mean, of course, there have been pockets of criticism, unsurprisingly, from NGOs who are ostensibly supported by the aid regime. But by and large, very, very happy with the response. And I'm glad that actually there are people who are interested in having the debate.
And not only NGOs, I'm looking here at a very recent essay by Michael Gerson, who worked for President George W. Bush and was involved in aid to Africa. He takes up the title of your book, Dead Aid, and his essay is headlined, Dead Aid, Dead Wrong. He's pretty critical. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, again, he is part of the establishment. I mean, he is one of the architects of the PEPFAR program, which, my God, I wish we had time so I could go through all the problems with that program.
This was President Bush's emergency plan for AIDS relief.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone knows who's involved. If you speak to a number of people on the ground, sort of 20 cents on the dollars actually getting to African clinics on that program. So I think it's really laughable when you hear criticisms coming from those type of quarters, because it's actually totally expected. The types of support that I'm getting, I believe, are if you look at sort of my website, for example, a lot of support from Africans, a lot of support from government officials, both in the West donor community and African governments. And so I actually view a lot of the commentary coming from NGOs as quite incidental and actually not surprising.
You say foreign aid has been bad for Africa and must stop. Begin to lay it out for us. Make your case, Dambisa Moyo.
Sure. I must say, first of all, this is not a surprising thesis. The book is actually dedicated to Peter Bauer. There have been many, many people before me who have criticized the aid model. I want to just clarify here, I'm not talking about humanitarian emergency aid, nor am I talking about NGO charitable aid. I'm talking about the large billion-dollar programs that go from government to government every year, primarily to African governments. If you look back in history over the past 60 years, has been about $1 trillion that's gone to Africa. The original goal of the architects of aid was to essentially provide growth and reduce poverty. On those two metrics alone, aid has absolutely failed. It continues to be an unmitigated political, humanitarian disaster, and certainly economic disaster across the continent. Africa, barring the last sort of 5 to 7 years when we had a commodity boom, has been shearing off, to borrow a phrase from academic Paul Collier. And we are not seeing the long-term sort of weaning off that one would expect after such a huge injection of capital has gone to the continent.
Let me understand that distinction in types of aid that you're drawing there. So if we think there's been, you know, Africa has been such a prominent target for aid, and there have been a lot of celebrities and others who have pushed hard for aid there, Live Aid and all the rest. When people have responded to those appeals, are you saying that's good, that's fine, it's something else, it's government-to-government aid that you're complaining about? Put it in terms that, that people may be able to look back over their own giving or their government's giving and recall, Dambisa.
Sure. I should preface this by saying that I actually am on the board of a number of charities. But I think it's important to understand what charitable aid can and cannot do. It can provide band-aid solutions. It cannot ensure that Africa grows at the rates of economic growth that we would want to see in order to meaningfully reduce poverty. So to give you an example, yes, you can provide money towards a scholarship for a girl to go to school. But what we've seen is that very often that girl doesn't end up finding a job when she comes out because the economies are not growing rapidly enough. Yes, HIV interventions can help as a band-aid solution provide livelihoods for people on the ground in Africa, but this is not what we would want to see. We want ultimately African governments to have responsibility for their healthcare sectors, for education, infrastructure, security, and so on. And so, again, stepping in, as many of these NGOs do, is simply a band-aid solution and is not going to ensure that Africa becomes an equal partner on the global stage.
You've said, look at Asia, countries with economies like China. It's been a long time since they were recipients of aid. Aid hasn't really been part of their formula post-Maoism and opening back up to the world. So are you saying that because Africa got aid and, I don't know, China didn't, that's why China's economy has been booming along in recent years and Africa hasn't? Is it as simple as that?
Well, it's not just China or India. It's also places like South Africa and Botswana on the African continent that have had a deliberate policy of not relying on open-ended aid commitments. Yes, countries like Botswana have taken aid. In the book, I talk about this class of countries called aid graduates. They've taken aid, but they always understood that it was a temporary mode of support and it was not an open-ended permanent income or commitment. That is ultimately the delineation between what has happened in places like South Africa, Botswana, China, India, and so on, versus what we are seeing in Africa. And what I'm criticizing is the fact that many of the aid advocates are pursuing and are keen to see a permanent infusion of capital with no clear end in sight. And to me, that is not a formula for success. And it's not just based on hubris. It's based on evidence and logic. Countries that have depended on aid have consistently underperformed economically and have seen a perpetual increase in poverty. Countries that have not relied on aid to the extent that Africa has have seen an incredible movement of people out of poverty and also an unprecedented economic growth.
So let's bring it up to date. September 2000, the UN, United Nations Millennium Summit, big commitments made there in the Millennium Declaration, including to Africa, 21 targets that they've got there to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger and achieve universal primary education, promote gender equality, reduce child mortality, and big dollars attached to them by 2015. Those sound like laudable goals. Are you against that kind of support?
Well, let's again look at the fact that we are in 2009, just a few years shy of the 2015 Millennium Development Goals. And we all know, certainly if you ask Africans on the ground, everybody knows that not a single one of those goals will be achieved. This is not me making claims. The architects of the Millennium Development Goals themselves are on record as saying that Africa is likely to be unable to meet even one of those goals. I think we spend a lot of time, waste a lot of time and resources skirting around trying to find or to continue down a path that we know has not delivered long-term economic growth, rather than focusing on ensuring that we deliver on the programs and the policies that we know have actually generated growth. I talk about that in my book, things like trade and foreign direct investment and so on. We spend a lot of time, deliberating when we actually know what works. And this is what I find particularly infuriating.
You say aid has hampered, stifled, and retarded Africa's development. I'm not sure it'll be obvious to people if that's so, why that's so. Trillions of dollars would seem to be helpful.
Well, let's just look at it very fundamentally before I get into the sort of manifestations of the problem. The fundamental problem is giving free money, ostensibly free money, at any time, anywhere on earth, it actually removes the carrot of serious money for those who would strive for it. And I'm paraphrasing here the words of Neil Ferguson. But it also takes away the stick of hardship for those who are willing to be idle. So what you end up with a situation where there's a lot of aid dependency, there's corruption, there's inflation, there's a debt burden. And ultimately, if there's one particular problem that I think is pernicious and completely unacceptable, is the fact that African governments can and very often are not accountable to Africans themselves. So they spend a lot of time courting Western donors. Many ministers in Africa complain about the revolving doors of NGOs coming into their offices. But ultimately, African governments are spending a lot of time listening to the donors, talking to the donors, and they don't have to respond to the African citizenry themselves. It's very much like no taxation without representation. Until there is a critical mass of middle-class Africans who are being taxed by the government, you will not have the governments responding to or being accountable to the Africans on the ground.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about aid to Africa, with a young African economist who says enough, and looking at the debate over her provocative thesis that it's time to stop aid to Africa. Dambisa Moyo joins us from London. She's worked for Goldman Sachs, been an advisor to the World Bank, out of Zambia, but with degrees from the American University and Harvard and Oxford. Her new book is Dead Aid. We'll hear in a moment from a critic, a big critic of the thesis. Let's first get a call here from Boston. Ngole, you're on the air with Dambisa Moyo.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. I just want to congratulate your guest for the brave step she has taken, because this is what I've been thinking all along. I'm from Cameroon. I came to the United States 6 years ago, and there's been this trend of receiving aid from the West, getting checks without accountability. And the reason I'm saying is that it's a nation like Cameroon, which has been, it's been a peaceful nation ever since independence. But what has happened is that it's creating a government that is not accountable to the people. It is, the government is not producing jobs. What it does is that it's only to sustain those who have who are politically affiliated with them. And if a call for cutting down aids to Africa, I think it will help to judge the government if they can create jobs, if they're better to suit the needs of the people rather than just giving them checks to keep up the same practice they've been doing.
Ngole, we've got it. No more checks without accountability. Thank you. Though a lot of aid groups now talk about accountability, but thank you. We'll look at that. Let me get a call from Buffalo, New York. Tom, you're on the air with Dambisa Moyo.
Hi, great show. I'm a little surprised about the subject and the person you have on, because I find it rather disturbing, and you used the perfect word in the transition, provocative. And I think that's all this is, provocative. Because the facts just totally waste away her argument. She even admits 20% of the money that governments give get to the African people. Now, that's 20% of $1 zillion. And then she categorizes it, but that's the only thing she argues about. She doesn't argue about private donations. She doesn't argue about charity donations. It's only government to government. The insanity of her argument is beyond me.
What about the markets to lift Africa up,
okay,
Tom?
Okay, let's talk about the market. If capitalism is the true reality, which we are seriously arguing about now, would not have private industry gone into Africa in the past 50 years and made it some kind of mecca.
Some Kind of Paradise. Tom, let us pick it all up. Dambisa Moyo, you know, first of all, I mean, Tom doesn't go for your whole thesis, but he says if the markets would have worked, they should have worked by now. What do you say?
Absolutely. I completely agree with Tom. First of all, I just want to clarify, Africa and Africans are not interested in being dependent on Western largesse over the long term. So, yes, it is true, as I pointed out, that 20 cents on the dollar does get to Africa. But that is the responsibility of African governments, not the responsibility of PEPFAR or the Americans to underwrite African on the ground. So I'm sorry, but very much like I'm sure Americans would not want to be surviving on handouts from elsewhere, Africans are not interested in long term being dependent on Western largesse. Now, with respect to the markets, I just want to paraphrase what President Obama just said in his inaugural speech, which is that, you know, essentially, whether we like it or not, we have over 300 years of history to suggest very clearly that in terms of wealth creation and alleviating poverty, the free market system is the best system that we know. It obviously needs to be regulated. If you read the work that I've just put out in my book, you would know that a lot of the reasons why it is that companies do not go to Africa is that doing business across most of Africa is an absolute nightmare. In some countries, it takes up to 2 years to get a business license. And your caller, Tom, has really underscored the problem. If African governments lived and died by the private sector existing, we would have a much more attractive environment under which companies and investors from around the world and domestically would be interested in investing.
You point
That's
in the
not
book,
the world that we have.
You point to China and China's investment in Africa and its deals in Africa as maybe the model, and they have poured a lot of money in there to bring natural resources out for their big industrial machine economy. But how is that going as the market has stumbled recently? I mean, we see news of big deals kind of falling apart there. Is the China model for Africa holding up, in your view, Dambisa Moyo?
Of course, these are challenging times. It's not just America that's suffering. It's a global crisis. I will point out, however, if you look at the IMF statistics, right now the forecasts for growth in Africa are 3%. Now, obviously, this might seem relatively paltry to some people, but in a year when we're expecting the globe to grow at 0.5% and many regions of the world to actually contract significantly, this is not a bad statistic. Now, with respect to the Chinese in particular, my book is basically arguing that their approach to Africa and Africans is a very welcome and healthy approach. They come to Africa to do business. Yes, it's not perfect. Of course, it needs to be managed. We expect African governments to behave and act on behalf of Africans, and therefore there is scope for much more accountability and better management of that relationship. However, you know, many Africans do not want to raise their children under the model that has been dominant in the past 60 years, which is one of aid and sympathy and couched in pity. We know what works. Let's use the model that works. Enough with this whole Africa sympathy thing. The Chinese model, yes, is going to have challenges. Of course, there are programs that are being pulled. But ultimately, the idea of bringing in incentives and opportunities for Africans to have jobs, I mean, for crying out loud, that's what Africans want. I'm sorry to shock you. People don't want to be dependent on aid. They want jobs, and aid has not delivered the jobs that we need on the ground.
We're going to get a counter view in just a minute. Let's hear from Grayson in Fort Myers, Florida. First, hi, Grayson. You're on the air.
Hi there. And I have been waiting for you, Ms. Samoya, for 20 years. I left Liberia 85 to 87, right before the war. Corruption was rampant. $28 million in, $2 million would hit the ground. That was the joke in the U.S. Embassy. $12 million in economic support funds disappeared from USAID's bank account overnight when they changed directors.
Grayson, what were you doing in Liberia? Were you with the U.S. government?
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in forestry, trying to save the jungle, which was impossible because of the corruption.
And if you took the aid away, do you think we'd see a better reality emerge in Africa or I don't know, more suffering?
It's just a racket. The only projects that have any hope are microloans and roads and some health projects. The rest are just a waste. It's just a nice way to have a expat job, make money, not pay too much U.S. taxes.
Grayson, we hear it. Dambisa Moyo in London, please stand by. I want to get another perspective. Hear it. Joining us now from New York is John MacArthur. He is chief executive of the Millennium promise. It's set up to help achieve the UN's 8 Millennium Development Goals, including halving global poverty by 2015. One of its partners is the Earth Institute, led by Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia University, who's been our guest here any number of times. John MacArthur, thank you very much for being with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Hi, Tom. Hi, Tembisa.
So,
hi, how are you?
Here you are. You're looking to flesh out the support for those goals, and along comes Dambisa Moyo. Is this your worst nightmare, John?
No, I don't think so. Not at all. I think there's, as one of the callers mentioned, there's a lot of confusion around the evidence. And the basic thing that we have to do is unpack the issues here. We need to make sure we're not, I drew the analogy recently to looking at the history of questionable contracts at the Pentagon and then saying, let's disband the military. We have to really be understanding what works, what doesn't, what the real flows are. And I think it's important. I actually have to confess, I don't recognize all the arguments that Dambisa is attributing to other people. I don't think anyone has an interest in long-term, or should have an interest, certainly, in long-term permanent aid. Certainly the Africans I work with are very keen. They're very much looking for accountability, empowerment, support. I agree with everything Dambisa said in that regard. And I think the basic question is, how do we actually understand what has worked so far? And there have been many tremendous successes, like in AIDS control, measles control, malaria control, food production in Malawi in just the past couple of years. Enrollments boosting by more than 30 million children in primary school across the continent. On AIDS, for example, at the turn of this decade, there was no one in Africa on AIDS treatment amidst a pandemic reaching 25 million people and no support externally for treatment. And now we're at more than 2 million people on treatment, which is a great success. And the Global Fund to Fight AIDS to Beat Malaria is another program in addition to the U.S. program mentioned. And we have to understand, these are both crucial as underpinning for people to be productive in the workforce, to be able to create and get those jobs that we'd all love to see created and everyone, I think, should be working towards in a market-oriented economy. But the basic question is, how do we scale up these basic, practical, accountable, transparent mechanisms that have had great successes in some areas and need more successes in others?
But we don't want to paper this over, John. I mean, you're very gracious, but you're much more kind of respectful to Dambisa's view than she is of the aid community generally. I mean, she's saying, just put a stop to this. 5 years, done, out. Let the markets essentially take over. Let the African nations borrow in the private capital markets and off they go on their own, period, get out.
Well, I think that's a false choice, very honestly. And I think there I would just make two basic points. Mm-hmm. One is that I know, Dambisa, so you've been using the number of $1 trillion over the past 60 years. I'm not sure exactly where that comes from. 1949
from the World
seems
Bank and IMF numbers.
But 1949 seems an odd reference point in 2009. And I think what we really need to look at is the more recent numbers. But even all time since 1960, the official data suggests that we're about $800 billion total from all parts of the world to all of sub-Saharan Africa. That works out to, just to put it in context, any reference point, $35 per person in Africa per year. That's about the current volume. In the United States right now, total bilateral assistance is about $6 billion to Africa. That includes PEPFAR, the AIDS program.
Mm-hmm.
That includes all the humanitarian relief. That includes the food aid. That includes also, of course, the consultants and the technical support. That's everything. That compares to, for example, a $3.6 billion publicly subsidized bonus for one bank last year, Merrill Lynch, amidst a $15 billion quarterly loss. It compares to a $600 billion Pentagon budget. We're now seeing multi-trillion dollar bailouts for financial institutions that are getting huge amounts of aid. And this country supports bilaterally $6 billion to Africa, which is an extremely small amount of money. And so I think if we understand how small the numbers are at any sense of macroeconomics to begin with, then we can unpack, of course, certain pieces haven't worked so well, and let's not continue those or let's not scale them up. But let's look at the great ones that have worked well.
But you call them small. She does not exactly call them small. And whatever they are, she says they've hampered, stifled, and retarded Africa's development. Let's turn that around for a second, John. If you were to follow Dambisa Moyo's formula here, take it to private markets, private borrowing, you know, put the markets in charge of Africa. She says that's the way to open the door, to open opportunity, to maybe let Africa be like Asia. Take the gloves off, because she's certainly got them off in her side of the ring. What do you think that would mean for Africa?
Well, again, I just think we have to stick with the evidence. And I think that that would be, you know, relatively tantamount to advocating subprime lending. These are many of the poorest people on the planet. These are economies that are at about $300 per capita of GNP. This is extraordinary poverty. We've seen what subprime lending looks like in this country, in the United States, and what that's led to. We're in the middle of one of the worst global credit crises, mm-hmm. of course, in history. And what do we say? Sorry, the investment bankers have made some mistakes. No money for AIDS treatment this year. We can't afford the higher interest payments. It just seems like it's putting all of the risk and all the burden on the poorest places in the world. And, you know, the bluest of blue chip companies right now can't issue bonds. How are we meant to expect Burundi or other countries that are in desperate poverty to issue bonds? I want to be clear, I am all for market mechanisms. And I am certainly all supportive of the long-term aspiration of countries getting to the point where they could, you know, successfully issue bonds. And that is hopefully a thing that could be done over the longer term. But even a country like Ghana, which is cited in this book, mm-hmm. it had a successful bond issuance in 2007 during the middle of the credit bubble. It was a very positive step. But that was alongside more than a billion dollars of annual aid to pay for basic social programs. So I think we need to remove the false choice and understand that it's aid and market mechanisms and trade and foreign investment. And it's the package that is needed, because you need clinics, you need roads, you need education, and you need jobs.
Dambisa, how about it? Aid plus or cut it off and go, Dambisa?
Well, I think I find it laughable that we can sit here after the billions of dollars that have gone to Africa and still make excuses for a system that has not delivered in terms of jobs. If we are going to sit here in 2009 and say, oh, well, it's not $1 trillion, it's about $800 billion that's gone to Africa, and guess what? 30 million African children in recent history have gotten education, and 2 million Africans are not HIV. AIDS, these are the outcomes that we're going to raise as a banner, then we really are in a worse situation than I had expected. Now, I'm not saying that, these interventions, as I said earlier, I'm not saying at all that these interventions are useless. What I am saying is that I am not interested, as an African, in sitting on a continent or living on a continent or having my family live on a continent where there are no serious prospects for turning the situation around. I want to know how many Africans have got jobs out of this system. The fact of the matter is that number is pretty low. In fact, it might not even exist in terms of the data available. Things like corruption, unfortunately, are not issues of the past. Just 6 weeks ago, the president of Malawi has been charged with stealing aid. And, you know, I find it interesting that Malawi is hailed in this conversation as one of the examples of a place where there's actually been benefit. My own former president of Zambia, President Chiluba, is embroiled in a scandal right now with respect to aid money again being diverted. I don't understand what the obsession is with aid. We know what works. We need to be aggressive. We need to hold not just African governments accountable, but also the whole community of aid workers who think it's okay to look at the African record over the past 60 years and actually grasp at straws for evidence that that aid actually is working. We know what works. African governments need to be not only accountable, they need to be at the forefront of providing education, healthcare, infrastructure, and security, and it should not be left incumbent on foreigners to do that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about aid to Africa. My guest Dambisa Moyo is out with a new book, Dead Aid, Why Aid Is Not Working and How There Is a Better Way for Africa. She argues against it, argues for more market forces on the African continent. John MacArthur is with us as well. He's chief executive of the Millennium Promise. It was set up to help achieve the UN's 8 Millennium Development Goals, including cutting global poverty in half by 2015 with no small amount of aid engaged in that, as envisioned. John MacArthur in New York, there's Dambisa Moyo in London, and she's ready to put her dukes up and go here. You know, but and I'm looking at our callers. We've got a lot who are really responding to it. You know, what do you make of the way that popular opinion is quite ready to give Dambisa Moyo a hearing? Lots of people have chipped in for Africa, but lots are also ready to say, let's turn the page.
Well, I think it's, again, why we have to be just very careful and not to be persuaded by grand statements that might not be anchored in the evidence. And so, and even I was quite surprised when Dambisa, you just said that, you know, it's laughable to focus on, say, 2 million people on AIDS treatment amidst a pandemic that was, you know, ravaging extraordinary amounts of the population. Obviously, I hope we're not talking about AIDS treatment versus anything else, because, of course, people need to be healthy and productive to get those jobs that we all want to see created. So I also want to say that, in my view, aid programs are most successful when they're led by African leadership, technical, political, community leaders, put forward for international review and technical review in kind of a neutral third-party sense. And this is the way the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria works, for example. And then the rich countries finance them in a partnership structure so that there's a co-financing, a joint venture, if you will. This is where we've seen so many of the greatest successes. We saw it with measles control, for example, another example where there's 90% reduction in child measles deaths between 2000 and 2006. That's 1,000 lives a day saved. But the other issue is that we don't want to entertain this false choice between market and other forms of investment. We, of course, need public and private investments. And the key issue is that there are limits to market forces. For people who have no money, who might see $20 or $30 in a year in cash, we don't want to go and say, here, go borrow $100. That's the ultimate in subprime lending. Similarly, we want people to be able to take on and countries to be able to take on a financial burden that they can afford. And the reality is that in extreme poverty cases, they can't afford very much. And we've seen throughout Asia, actually, the evidence is quite strong, the role of public investments, especially in the prime economic productive sector, which is agriculture and rural areas, and where major public investments and often supported by foreign aid in places like Korea, the Philippines, India, Pakistan, Indonesia, made huge breakthroughs to then create the conditions for more of the jobs to take off as people could then have enough food to eat, have enough to sell, and then create the labor markets that lead to more specialized market forces.
Ms. Moyo,
so I think we just have to avoid this false choice.
Ms. Moyo, in London, how about it? John MacArthur sounds like he's kind of bending over backwards. He's acknowledging the market could be good, but he says let's not make a false choice. But I'm not sure from reading your book that you're in the same ballpark here. You're saying stop the aid.
Yep. If you actually, people actually never seem to get to the end of the last chapter. I actually do come up with some suggestions on how we wean African countries off of aid. There is a small, albeit very small, amount of aid that I completely see the justification for. But you know, let's not get, you know, quibble with the main thesis of the book, which is that what we're looking for is very much in the vein of what's just been described as what happened with Korea, India, with the Green Revolution, and so on, are finite commitments. Yes, we can say Africa needs aid for the next 5 or 10 years or whatever a period, but it has to be finite. It has to be credible. What I find rather perplexing is the notion that a lot of people who are diehard aid advocates say, "Oh, well, actually, we do think that the markets also work." But that's not the message that that is coming across. The message that's coming across is that they need another $50 billion or plus to go to Africa a year. I don't see how an aid model that is, or a model of economics that is buttressed by that type of aid flow, is going to attract the type of investment that is required. We've seen the problems with this. In fact, if people actually bother to ask some of the African leadership, such as President Kagame, what his view is on the aid model of Rwanda, he's been very explicit that this is not a long-term system. It's debilitating. It's psychologically damaging, and it has not delivered in terms of jobs. It has had some impact on HIV/AIDS, and I might add there, I wasn't trying to be flippant. I'm ultimately saying that things like education and healthcare should be provided by African governments. Let us ask the hard questions. We've just come out of a major commodity boom. Why are we not asking African governments what has happened to that money? Why are we focusing on going to the G20 to ask for more money for Africa? These 2015 Millennium Development Goals are not going to be met. And before I hear the response that they're not going to be met, because the money hasn't been put in, we're not putting money in anymore because we've had enough. The Global Fund, which was touched on there, has rejected a number of countries, including my own country, from getting money from that pool of cash because of corruption. Let's find ways of circumventing or bringing in these negative incentives into these societies by handing out free cash. We need jobs. We know how to create jobs. We know how Chile did it. We know how South Africa's done it. Botswana, India, China, Russia. There's a whole list of countries that some of them were actually poorer than African countries just 20, 30 years ago. We know that these countries did not have open-ended commitments of aid. You know, the government stepped in, took accountability, and they've delivered in generating jobs. Africa is not going to show the double-digit rates of growth or even the 7% rates of growth, which the UN is postulated as saying is the minimum that's required to meaningfully reduce poverty. Africa will not achieve those rates of growth by relying on an aid model that is being prescribed. Mm. The interventions that people are talking about now are band-aid solutions. They affect a small proportion of Africa's population. We need broad-based approaches to ensure that Africans can provide for their families and they can hold their governments accountable. The type of minuscule interventions that we see are being proposed and asking for these large inordinate amounts of money is completely unacceptable, given the poor record that we can see across the world that no country has achieved long-term economic development relying on aid the way Africa does. And we know what works, that the markets actually, albeit in a regulated fashion, and yes, with the challenges that they bring, are still the best way of delivering growth and increasing wealth.
Dambisa Moyo of Zambia. John, yes.
Yeah, I think it's, again, this reference to extraordinary amounts of money, there's a financing gap that the rich countries have committed for next year that they're falling behind by $35 billion. So we're talking about a gap of $35 billion amidst a time of multi-trillion dollar bailouts for our own economy. And somehow that's considered an extraordinary amount of money.
But she's saying she doesn't want those billions.
But she's saying that that's a huge amount of money, and it's just not. The second thing I would say is that on the
billion dollars.
That's a very small amount of money. That's about, divide that over 700 million people. It does not go very far. You're looking at $50 per person. This is not anywhere near what we're paying in bailouts for major financial institutions right now, which just shows the
comparison.
Fallacy.
Why?
That's a complete false comparison because, first of all, the bailout, you're talking about bailouts to banks that are far more sophisticated in terms of the of their interconnectedness to these economies. Yes, these are large amounts in bailouts, but the implications of allowing these institutions, as we know, for failing and then saying, well, actually, they're giving this amount of money to Merrill Lynch or whoever versus giving it to Africans is completely, it is unjustified. I just don't understand what kind of logic that is.
The American people.
I'm sorry.
I don't understand how you can say investment bankers deserve bailouts, which are going to...
I didn't say that. I'm sorry. I did not say that, John. I did not say they deserve bailouts. I'm saying that the American government has been elected to support and has been voted into office to represent the American people. The American government is sitting there and saying, we can choose. We can either provide subsidy cut, for example, in the trading markets. We can actually say we can provide support for Africans on the ground, or we can ensure that the economy in the United States does not end up in a deep depression. They are charged with the responsibility of providing for Americans first, and that is the wish that I would have for Africans, that the African government are not concerned.
You think that the $6 billion for Africa is compared equally to the $6 billion for the financial institutions?
Well, you're picking $6 billion. If this were a one-year issue, I wouldn't be on the radio right now. This has been
a 60-year... But we have to talk about annual flows.
It's been a 60... Yes, it is an annual flow, but $6 billion from the United States government versus $50 billion when you add up everybody else who's giving money to Africa is unacceptable. And I strongly believe that if you put that $50 billion towards job creation, we would have seen a much better turnout than what we've seen right now, which is basically job creation for Westerners, no jobs on the ground in Africa. We've got epidemics galore. Nobody's asking the hard questions about what has happened to the money from the commodity boom. Nobody's asking why it is after 60 years, if you're even taking your conservative number of $800 billion, why it is that we're pushing up 3 million Africans, 2 million Africans are now on HIV retrovirals and 30 million education. How can we be looking at that and saying that that's an okay record?
Let's hear from our listeners, if we may, because so many have been waiting to get in here with the two of you. We've got Lemu on the air, truck driver on his way to Atlanta. Lemu, you're with us. Hi.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
We're pretty well. What do you know?
Well, what do I know? I mean, it's a very interesting topic today. I mean, I love your show, by the way.
And thank you.
This is a good way to find out why aid for Africa is not helping. Number one, see the leaders and where they were before they became leaders. That one good example would be the previous prime minister of Ethiopia, which is Meles Zenawi. He was a nobody when he became a prime minister. Now his wife and daughters goes to France for lunch in a private jet. That's one. And ask, you want to give aid? That's very good. Aid, Africa needs aid, but not in the form of cash. Go around and ask anybody what they need. The farmer needs a tractor.
Do you think, Lemu, that Africa would be better off if it was all private investment, if you put the AIDS money to the side, or not?
Absolutely. I mean, right now, if you go to Ethiopia and try to buy a house, it's almost the same as the price that you pay here in the United States. I mean, currency-wise, I sent a four-wheel drive to Ethiopia. It cost me $12,500 to enter Ethiopia. I mean, tax. Where does that tax money go?
That goes to government credibility, but it sounds like you're sympathetic with Ms. Moyo, and I appreciate your call. Let's get another right here. Melanie in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Melanie, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I haven't read Ms. Moyo's book, and I actually live in Tanzania. And one of the things that I'm interested in is if Ms. Moyo could talk about accountability for these donor agencies themselves. There was a statistic from the 80s about USAID that 80% of the money allocated for aid to Africa never actually left the United States. And of the 20% that actually made it to Africa, only 8% actually made it into the field. So I'm curious to know, you know, people like Tom from the Millennium Fund, the gentleman from the Millennium Fund.
John
McCarthy. I mean, what is their salary? This is a huge business for people who are in these aid agencies. They've got a huge reason to perpetuate the status quo, and until that changes on that end, I don't see how there's any benefit going to come to Africa, which is the whole point of aid.
Let us pick it up, John MacArthur. What do you say first to our Ethiopian truck driver in the U.S., Lemu, and here to Melanie?
Well, again, I work for a private organization funded by private philanthropists, many of whom have been quite successful in the private sector. So I want to be clear that I have not playing with skin in the game, only trying to be accurate. Mm-hmm. And I think when we look at the countries that have had success, and even, Rwanda was mentioned, you know, President Kagame and his team and cabinet members have done great work. They get some of the most aid per capita in Africa. They get about $60 per person per year, and they've had some of the greatest public health successes in history in the past couple of years alone with major reductions in infant mortality. So, I think we have to dispel this notion that nothing has been achieved. We could all spend hours talking about the stories of problems and things that haven't worked well. When we see that programs have been very transparent, linked to clear results, and I think linked to measurement and shared responsibility and financing distinct from management and accountability, we see that these are the key ingredients for successful programs.
You know, I have
Malawi,
to ask you,
for example,
our time is so short. How do you interpret this sort of fundamental different interpretation of what's going on? Dabisa Moyo, it's as if you and she look through different windshields. You see transparency, clear results, and we hear them. And she looks out on the same continent and says, overall failure, boot it. 5 years, aid, more or less, out.
Well, Dambisa is saying there's no jobs. She's I think, downplaying the major successes, especially in the past 10 years. And frankly, I'm not interested in talking about 1965. I think we should be talking about 2010 and 2015 and 2020 and the future. And I think that we have to understand where there have been the successes, as there have been, by the millions of people at a time in areas of health and education in particular. And not surprisingly, those were relative emphases. Dambisa also described a pretty successful accountability mechanism where a country put forward a proposal that was not deemed to be up to snuff, and the world's largest kind of multilateral health funding agency for disease control, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, declined it. That would fit the model of transparency and accountability. So we also need to understand that there are countries like Malawi that have actually doubled their food production through the basic economic tool of fertilizer and seeds, which is, if you're a farmer, a core tool. And if you're a farmer and you can't afford that $60 or $100 bag of fertilizer, which is what so many farmers by the hundreds of million face every year around rural Africa, you typically need some basic support to afford that.
John
and
MacArthur,
that's what happened around Asia. And they've doubled their food production.
We're out of clock right here. John MacArthur, Chief Executive of the Millennium Promise. We thank you very much for being with us today, John. Thank you for your time and thoughts. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dambisa Moyo, final thought as we go out here. What, you're going to deny that farmer $60 for a bag of fertilizer, Dambisa?
We have over 60% of the African population is under the age of 24. We need jobs. We don't need any more smoke and mirrors. Yes, these interventions may help in the interim. They're Band-Aid solutions. President Kagame of Rwanda, yes, absolutely right, highly dependent on aid, but and yet he's one of the most vocal African leaders saying we need to get off of this aid. We need to ask the question, why would he say that? Why would he be saying that if the record
of aid
is so great?
We've got your message. We're out of time. The book is Dead Aid. Behind us right now, U2, the Live Aid Concert 2005. Dambisa Moyo joining us from London. Listeners, thanks for being with us. Interesting. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.